You're listening to Asbury University's Chapel Podcast, recorded live from our campus in Wilmore, Kentucky. Asbury's Chapel Service hosts speakers from around the world to inspire academic excellence and spiritual vitality. We hope you enjoy today's message.
I can tell you, when I first started writing on the Anxious Bench with David in 2015, I had no idea where that would take me. Because the making of biblical womanhood began on the Anxious Bench. So you just never know what's going to happen. Today, I'm going to talk to you about why I decided to write the making of biblical womanhood. And I have to put my glasses on because I got old through this process. So I will begin. It set at the end of our counter for almost a week. Beginning of school notices for carpool and parent meetings, along with that odd mail that never seems to have a place, piled on the stapled manila pages. Occasionally, I would pick it up, shake off the mail, and look at it. It was from Brazos Press. We'd been discussing a new book project for several months, tentatively titled The Making of Biblical Womanhood. And this was the official contract. "Are you going to sign that?" my husband would ask. His words were familiar by now, recycled in my own thoughts. "I think so," I would answer. But you know, I really wasn't sure. I really wasn't sure if I wanted to write it. I really wasn't sure if the cost would be worth it. Would it be worth it if I was accused of not believing the Bible? I knew the very premise of the book, that the belief God calls men to lead and women to follow isn't the scriptural mandate evangelicals think it is. Or put more simply, biblical womanhood is not biblical. I knew this very premise would raise questions about my orthodoxy. I knew the unusual approach, historical evidence blended with personal experience, had the potential to be powerful precisely because it required vulnerability. Would it be worth it if my identity as a scholar was questioned because of my identity as a Christian? Would it be worth it for so many people, a whole lot more now than I ever imagined, would know the hardest stories of my life? So I let that contract sit for several days at the end of my counter. It wasn't gathering dust. It was gathering my fears and a little bit of mail. I think my worries were understandable. Indeed, everything I feared has come to pass, some of it many times over. Yet as I stand here, more than 2 years after I signed that contract, more than 9 months, I can't believe it's been that long, after publication, you know what I found? I found that my fears were misplaced. Not that they weren't real, but they were misplaced. Instead of worrying about the cost of writing, I should have been worrying about the cost of not writing. So let me explain, and you're going to have to indulge me with a little bit of medieval history because, y'all, that's what I do. In the final chapter of The Making of Biblical Womanhood, I share the story of a woman named Christine de Pizan, which I really hope a lot of you have heard of by now. She was a 15th century widow who supported her family as a professional writer, which is actually a very rare thing in the medieval world. She wrote poetry, devotional religious texts, and a biography of the deceased French king, Charles V, commissioned by his brother, Philip of Burgundy. Her most famous work, however, involves her response to a literary text called The Romance of the Rose. Composed by two different authors between 1228 and 1270, it is an allegory of love about a young man questing after a rosebud. And as I usually tell the students in my class, I'll just let you use your imagination. It is highly misogynistic. For example, in one section, it warns against marriage because a wife will ruin your life. This is what it says. It says, marriage is, quote, a life too full of torment and strife and riotousness because of the pride of foolish women. Not to mention the, quote, dangers and reproaches which women do and say with their mouths, and requests and complaints which women invent on many occasions. It takes a great effort to keep them and hold back their foolish wills. C.S. Lewis once described The Romance of the Rose as one of the most popular vulgar texts ever written. That was long before 50 Shades of Grey. So I wonder now how C.S. Lewis would classify it. But nonetheless, it was a vulgar, misogynistic text that demeaned women, and everybody was reading it. I mean, seriously, I use 50 Shades of Grey because I think I felt as appalled about people reading 50 Shades of Grey as Christine de Pizan felt about people reading The Romance of the Rose. All of her friends were reading it. The popularity of the text simply angered her. In fact, today, the reason we know her so well is because of her response to it. She wrote a series of letters attacking it. She won the support of the chancellor of the University of Paris. She then wrote a lengthy prose response countering the book, too. I suspect, I hope, some of you have read at least portions of it. If we were smaller, I'd make you tell me the title. But it is The Treasure of the City of Ladies. Are y'all familiar with that? Do you know what it's about? Christine realized that the problem with The Romance of the Rose was that it spread dangerous ideas about women. So she wrote The City of Ladies as an alternate narrative. Instead of folk learning misogynist ideas about women, she wanted them to know the truth about women throughout history who had made valuable contributions to society. In fact, she does some really unusual and provocative things in that book, including elevating the status of the Virgin Mary to essentially a priestly role. Now, question, of course, is why did Christine get so upset about this? I mean, just think about it. We've all been at social gatherings, well, fewer now than we used to in the past, but we've all been at social gatherings where people have made inappropriate comments that upset us, that anger us. But how many of us actually do something about it? How many of us actually directly counter those inappropriate jokes that all of our friends are spreading around? Christine did. You know, and she didn't have to either. She had a pretty cushy life. Now, granted, she built that life herself. Her life had been hard. Her husband and father both died when she was young. She was in her 20s, and she found herself a single mom who had to support her extended family. You know, she's truly an incredible woman. And as you see, she did a really good job of it, becoming one of the first women we know of who earned her living as a professional writing for some of the wealthiest and most influential people in her world. It strikes me, though, that the very audience who read The Romance of the Rose was the very audience who supported Christine's work. So she was essentially speaking out against the hand that fed her. I can tell you from experience that takes a little bit of courage. So why did she do this? Why did a 15th century woman take on the literary aristocratic world of 15th century Europe? Well, she gives us a clue in one of her letters. And one of the remarkable things also that Christine did is that not only did she write these responses, but then she gathered up all of the responses that she wrote, as well as all of the other people who wrote letters trying to counter her that then she wrote back in response to them. She gathered them all up and kept them. And then she also wrote an analysis of them, okay? She wanted people to know what was going on. So this is what she said in one of those letters. And I quote, "A married man believed in the romance of the rose as in the gospel. This was an extremely jealous man who, whenever in the grip of passion, would go and find the book and read it to his wife. Then he would become violent and strike her and say such horrible things as, 'These are the kind of tricks you pull on me.' This good, wise text knew well what women are capable of. And at every word he finds appropriate, he gives her a couple of kicks or slaps. Thus, it seems clear to me that whatever other people think of the romance of the rose, this poor woman pays too high a price." Do you hear that? Could it be that Christine de Pizan became an activist for medieval women, taking on the literary world of 15th century Europe because she saw the abuse of one woman? While there are scholarly debates about whether Christine de Pizan had a feminist consciousness, at the end of the day, she saw the connection between abusive behavior towards women, physical, emotional, psychological, economic, and misogynist ideas about women. She understood that ideas matter. Ideas that treat women as less than men lead to men treating women as less. So she decided to act, using what she had to fight against misogyny, to love those whom God loves, to help make the lives of women better, even the life of that poor woman who pays too high a price. A 15th century woman saw the plight of women in her world, how they were belittled, abused, disempowered, and she decided to act, regardless of the consequences for herself. Indeed, it was Christine's courage that inspired the scripture text I chose today, Genesis 16. Because Christine not only did what was right, y'all, I think maybe she followed an example set by God. I'm not going to read the whole text again, but I want to think about what happens. You know, sometimes it takes years of reading a text before it finally really sinks into you what's going on. And when the text, the story of Genesis 16 sinks in, it's a pretty terrible story. Stories about a powerless woman who is raped, abused, and abandoned. Just think about it. Hagar is the slave of Sarai. And no matter how we try to make that prettier than it is and try to pretend that slaves in the past were treated better than slaves in 19th century America, it's not true. The condition of slavery places a human being under the power of another human being. And that's what Hagar was. She was under the power of Abram and Sarai. She's given to Abram for the sole purpose of sex. She's not asked about this. She has no choice. When she becomes pregnant, she is mistreated. And that word there is probably another soft word. She was probably beaten by Sarai, severely enough that she runs away from the only refuge she knows. You know, I've seen Sunday school descriptions of what happened to this, and it shows Sarai yelling at Hagar. Y'all, Hagar wouldn't have run away for Sarai yelling at her. I mean, this was a world in which she would have been used to that type of treatment. I'm sure she was scared for her life. I'm sure she was scared for the life of the child she was carrying. So she ran away. She had no social support networks. There was nobody to help her. This shocking sequence of events is made even more shocking by the identity of the perpetrators, the man and woman chosen by God to become the parents of his chosen people. So Hagar is now a homeless, battered, pregnant slave girl driven out into the desert. And it is at this moment, the darkest part of her story, that everything changes. And this is why I chose the text. Because God sees her. God sees her, an abused, pregnant, friendless slave. He sees her and he acts. Did you hear that promise he made her? It should have rung bells for you because it is very similar to the promise that God made Abraham, that she would be the mother of descendants too numerous to count. I mean, it's an incredible promise because he saw her misery, how she was treated. Hagar's probably in shock, but she recognizes who God is, and she recognizes what God has done, and she becomes the first person in the Bible to name God, and she names him El Roy, the God who sees. Do you catch what inspired me about this story? Do you see the similarities? Just as God saw the hopeless plight of Hagar, an abused slave, Christine de Pizan saw the hopeless plight of an abused woman. Just as God acted to help Hagar, Christine acted to help that poor woman who pays too high a price. As a woman's historian, I find it striking that one of the first stories in the Bible is about a woman who could not help herself, yet God came to her. Which brings us back to the making of biblical womanhood and that contract sitting on my counter. For those of you who haven't read it yet, my argument is exactly what Lisa said this morning, that evangelical Christians have succumbed to the sin of patriarchy. We have become complicit in the oppression of women. We've tried to make it look pretty. We've dressed it up with words like biblical womanhood and complementarian. We've even packaged it in pink Bibles and sold it in marriage sermons. But at the end of the day, oppression is oppression and patriarchy is patriarchy. Patriarchy places power in the hands of men and takes it away from women. Patriarchy teaches men that women rank lower than they do. It teaches women that their voices are worth less than the voices of men. As I explain in the first chapter of my book, if men, simply because of their sex, have the potential to preach and exercise spiritual authority over a church congregation, but women, simply because of their sex, do not, then that gives all men power over all women. It isn't just different roles. It is a system that always puts women under the power of men. I still remember the moment I finally grasped how much Christian patriarchy hurts women. I was sitting in our high school youth room. My husband was going through a How to Teach series and had asked one of the young women to lead that night. However, he had to justify why she was able to do that. As I listened to him, I realized that all those young men in the room were being taught that there was something innate in their masculinity that made them able to lead in a way that women never could. Not because of their character, or because of their skill set, or because of their calling, but y'all, because of their bodies. I realized that the limits placed on this young woman by our church would spill over into her everyday life. You see, Christian patriarchy does not remain confined within the walls of our homes. It does not stay behind our pulpits. It cannot be peeled off suit coats like name tags as evangelical men move from denying women's leadership at church to accepting the authority of women at work or in the classroom. Complementarians may argue that women are equal to men, yet their insistence that equal worth manifests in unequal roles refutes this. A few weeks ago, I received a letter from a woman outside the U.S. Her pastor sent the letter for her. He contacted me through every social media platform he could find. He told me she was a student in his class who read The Making of Biblical Womanhood for her research project. He said it had a profound impact on her, and he wanted me to know. I just want you to hear her words, and I'm keeping it anonymous for obvious reasons. I've also edited it some for fluency. This is what she wrote me. She said, "When I was reading your book, I was crying through almost every chapter. It's such a shocking realization how deeply patriarchy has poisoned the worldview of Christians. It has turned Christianity into a weapon against women. I suddenly found that I had lost the joy of finding Jesus in my life. I took in the headship of men doctrine and persuaded myself again and again that it was me who was the problem. Thankfully, I got the chance to read your book, and I found my Jesus again. My Jesus who is actually for me and not against me, who is for women, not against women. The patriarchy is something we should fight as followers of Jesus. Thank you for not staying silent." Of course, on the morning of August 6, 2019, I had no way of knowing what would happen. I had no idea that people all over the world would read my words. I had no idea that The Making of Biblical Womanhood would help this young woman find her Jesus, much less ignite her to fight against patriarchy too. On the morning of August 6, 2019, y'all, I was still afraid of the personal cost to me. But I couldn't get rid of that nagging thought that because I was a Christian, because I knew the freedom of the gospel, that I had a responsibility to act, just like Christine de Pizan. I remember watching my daughter that morning in August as she sat at the kitchen bar eating a chocolate chip muffin, because I'm a good mom and that's the only way I can get her to eat, you know, something with fiber in it. I remember my son wandering into the kitchen, sleep still in his eyes. And it was at that moment that I realized the cost of writing The Making of Biblical Womanhood was worth it, because it wasn't about me. It was about my children. It was about the women I had taught and mentored. It was about the women in my evangelical world who, in the words of Christine de Pizan, pay too high a price for dangerous ideas held by men. It was about this young woman who cried her way through every chapter. It was about students like you. I signed the contract for The Making of Biblical Womanhood because I realized the cost to me was small compared to the good it could do for the evangelical world. I realized the cost of not speaking up, of allowing the status quo to remain unchallenged, would be far greater than the cost of staying silent. I realized that becoming an activist for women was not only something I could do, it was something I should do as a follower of Christ. The story of Hagar shows us a God who has always seen the plight of women and shows up to help them. I think it's about time the evangelical world starts doing the same. So thank you for having me.